Every day, your life is filled with choices. And when a health crisis happens, you need to be prepared to choose the best healthcare partner. That's when Shasta Regional Medical Center is there to answer the call above the rest. Ranked best in Reading and in the nation for patient safety and clinical excellence, you can be confident that when you choose Shasta, you are choosing superior care, safety, and excellence for you and your family. Choose Shasta at ShastaRegional.com.
John Cruz here with America Outdoors Radio. Be sure to tune in this weekend and catch the latest in fishing, hunting, conservation, and destinations. If you love spending time in the field or on the water or in the woods, you're going to love this show. It's America Outdoors Radio, the fastest growing outdoors radio show in the nation. Tune in Saturdays from noon to 1 p.m. on 96.5 FM and 1460 AM KCNR, your talk radio.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
Even polarization within our politics is also largely driven by the decline of marriage. And then, of course, there's the future of humanity. You're seeing this demographic decline, not just in this country, but across the world. And again, also being driven by the decline of marriage.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That was Con Carroll, author of the recent book, Sex and the Citizen, How the Assault on Marriage is Destroying Democracy. We'll talk in depth with Con about that book a little bit later on in today's program. First, we're joined by Dr. Larry Arn, president of Hillsdale College. Dr. Arn has spent decades studying Winston Churchill, the great British statesman and prime minister of the United Kingdom from 1940 to 1945, also again from 1951 to 1955. Hillsdale has published the official biography of Winston Churchill. Dr. Arn helped to complete it. We also have a website. You can find all sorts of info, winstonchurchill.hillsdale.edu. And we talked to Dr. Arn today just after the 150th anniversary of Churchill's birth, November 30th, 1874, to discuss three reasons you might want to study Winston Churchill. Dr. Arn, start us off. What's the first reason people might want to take a deeper look at Winston Churchill?
The first reason is he lived a big life. Big, I think, or bigger than any statesman who ever lived. He was in four wars. Became a best-selling author about those wars, both in books and in newspaper articles. Probably the most read person about those four wars. And then he turned 26 and got elected to Parliament. And then his life went on through writing almost 50 books, 8,000 closely printed pages of speeches, all written by him, very powerful and beautiful. The books are very worth reading. And he held every major office in the British government except Foreign Secretary, which he did part-time once during the Second World War. He was in both those big wars, hated them, tried to figure out how to fight them, tried to prevent them, wrote about them compellingly, what they mean as a phenomenon in the world, something new and something terrible. He understood the modern form of tyranny. We call it totalitarianism. We still have it in the world today. It is the most dangerous form of human association, the most destructive. And he predicted it, and he resisted it, and he made war against it, and he prevented it from coming to his country. That's a big life. Fun life, too. He had a great sense of humor. A lady said to him one time, we're all worms, Winston. He said, yes, but I am a glowworm. Anybody who thinks of things like that, fun.
Dr. Arn, the second reason that you say people might want to study Winston Churchill is he was a defender of self-government. How do we see that inside Churchill's life?
There are two things that are worth mentioning here, I think, that his life means. He understood his own life, and he understood the life of Britain in his time and America as a test whether we could choose and rule ourselves. The first paragraph of the Federalist Papers says, America is a test whether we can guide our lives by reflection and choice or whether we must depend on accident and force. Churchill wanted people to be in control of their government because he believed that they were made by nature to be in control of their lives. He fought for that all his life. He trusted the people. He said wittily once, democracy is the worst form of government except all the other forms. He said of America, they'll always do the right thing after they've tried everything else. But they will eventually do it. He thought they were the best judge of their own lives. He was an enemy of something that we have a major battle about in America today. He was an enemy of bureaucracy. He thought legislatures ought to make laws. He thought laws should be few and simple. He wrote some very significant laws in his time, and they are simple. You can understand them. He thought that the law should be understandable to everybody, so there wouldn't grow up a class of people to enforce the laws. He coined the phrase about the bureaucracy once, no longer civil, no longer servants. In that same speech, which was given in 1945, he said that the socialists could not achieve their ultimate aims without the use of a Gestapo. He said, of all the people on earth, the British should be the last to consent to be governed by bureaucracy. Those are very telling things to say in the context of today and the things going on in today. Today in America, the government is half the economy. The power of government is concentrated in the most central government, farthest away from the people. And there's a fight about that. Churchill has profound things to say about that. That's something that he means. He means self-government. He fought for it. It's the reason he hated Nazism. It's the reason the culminating thing in his life was the terrible choice made in May 1940 to carry on fighting against the Nazis, against overwhelming odds, which he knew would cost his country so much that it wouldn't be a great country anymore. And it was true. That's what happened. But he thought the risk of becoming associated with Hitler or falling in any sense under his influence was something to be prepared to die for, over. And he was.
Dr. Larry Arnn joining us, president of Hillsdale College, as we talk about three reasons you might want to study Winston Churchill. And Dr. Arnn, this third reason is that Churchill had some thoughts, some ideas into the ultimate purposes of life. What did he think and say?
Good politics protects our right to pursue the ultimate purposes of life, them. Churchill was never a totalitarian. He never thought that you could go to heaven through the law, but he thought you ought to try, and you had a right to try. This is my favorite paragraph he ever wrote, and I'm going to read it to you. It's in an essay called 50 Years Hence. His essays are very worth reading, and this is one of the best of them. And in this, he did something he likes to do, which is predict the future. He actually was pretty good at that, although another favorite saying of his was, the future, though imminent, is obscure. He writes, I read a book the other day, and it traced the history of mankind from the birth of the solar system to extinction. There were 15 or 16 races of men which in succession rose and fell over periods measured by tens of millions of years. In the end, a race of beings was evolved which had mastered nature. A state was created whose citizens lived as long as they cared, enjoyed pleasures and sympathies incomparably wider than our own, navigated the interplanetary spaces, could recall the panorama of the past and foresee the future. You know, if we actually managed to embed artificial intelligence in ourselves, we might be able to do all that. Then he says, you know, and Churchill liked the future, and he liked to think about it, and he, you know, was an early aviator and helped to invent the tank to protect troops in warfare. And he describes this future, which kind of sounds like heaven on earth, right? And then he says the mood changes in a sentence. But what was the good of all that to them? What did they know more than we know about the answers to the simple questions which man has asked since the earliest? Why are we here? What is the purpose of life? Whither are we going? No material progress, even though it takes shapes we cannot now conceive, or however it may expand the faculties of man, can bring comfort to his soul. It is this fact, more wonderful than any that science can reveal, which gives the best hope that all will be well. You see what he's saying? We are not robots. We think about the future. We wonder who we are and why we're here. And the right to do that gives rise to, for example, the doctrines of the Declaration of Independence, that we are not the same thing as horses and may not be governed except with our consent. It also underscores the dignity of education, of speculation, of free thinking. Churchill was a defender of those things, and then what he adds is he was a man of immense practical wisdom, which we all need because we all have to make choices.
That's Dr. Larry Arn, president of Hillsdale College. You can find much more at our website, winstonchurchill.hillsdale.edu. Read a bit of Winston Churchill as we continue to celebrate the anniversary of his birth, November 30th, 1874. Up next, we're joined by Con Carroll to talk about his recent book, Sex and the Citizen, How the Assault on Marriage is Destroying Democracy. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
I'm Tracy Edwards, CEO of the Reading Rancheria. Giving back to our local community is a tradition that is firmly rooted in our history. It is with great honor and pride that we have been able to support several amazing local businesses like these over the years.
Thanks to the Reading Rancheria for their support of the Kiwanis Fiesta Dam Club Food for Kids program. We send 185 bags of food home every Friday. They're instrumental in helping us.
Reading Rancheria, proud to play our part.
The Shasta College Associate Degree Nursing Program is excited to announce a special application filing period for the fall 2025 cohort. This application period will be through 4 p.m. on Friday, January 24th, 2025. If you apply in January during the special open application period and are not selected for the fall 2025, you will need to reapply in June 2025 during the annual open application period for a chance to be invited into the spring or fall 2026 cohort. Visit ShastaCollege.edu for more information.
When people ask me for a recommendation for a heating or air conditioning company, I always say Alliance Heating and Air. Why? Well, they've been taking care of our HVAC system for 14 years. Professional, friendly, and willing to go to the extra step for their customers. I have found no problem too difficult or too minor for them to repair. I recommend Alliance Heating and Air with no reservations. You can reach them at 530-221-2642 or online at homecomfort.org. And they have 24/7 emergency assistance. Alliance Heating and Air.
Looking for the freshest top shelf flower? Look no further than the Queen of Dragons in the city of Shasta Lake, where they work directly with small local farmers to bring you the finest flower that fits your price. The Queen of Dragons has the best prices on carts, edibles, concentrates, and pre-rolls. Plus, don't miss happy hour every day from 6 p.m. until close and all day Sundays. Don't just stock up on toilet paper. The Queen of Dragons has great deals, so you can stock up on the best flower for the best prices. So what are you waiting for? Stop by Queen of Dragons at 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard or call 530-238-5638 for details or delivery. That's 530-238-5638. And don't forget to follow Queen of Dragons on Facebook and X at the Queen Dragons for all the latest deals and updates. Support Queen of Dragons, a local business in the city of Shasta Lake, where you will find the most friendly and knowledgeable staff. Queen of Dragons at 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard. Visit queenofdragons.com or follow us on X at the Queen Dragons.
If you're tired of artificial intelligence and dishonest news, tune in to Poke the Hornet's Nest every other Sunday at 8 a.m.
Join Nick Gardner and Doug Janke, two hosts who were educated at School of Hard Knocks. Get a layman's view of local government as well as our take on national and world events.
If you're woke, go back to bed. You won't like us. We believe there's a difference between a man and a woman, and I think you probably know what it is.
Tune in to Poke the Hornet's Nest every other Sunday, 8 a.m. here on KCNR1460.com, 96.5 FM, and 1468.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family-owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300, a reputation for excellence since 1965.
I'm Tracy Edwards, CEO of the Reading Rancheria. Giving back to our local community is a tradition that is firmly rooted in our history.
Thank you, Reading Rancheria, for supporting Tree of Life International Charter School. Gracias por todo su apoyo.
Thank you, Reading Rancheria!
The Shasta Lake Chamber of Commerce wants to thank the Reading Rancheria. They have sponsored our Friday night in the park for more than 18 years, and we really appreciate it.
Reading Rancheria, proud to play our part.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertrand. Be sure to check out the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. All of our audio at podcast.hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Con Carroll. He is commentary editor at the Washington Examiner at washingtonexaminer.com and also the author of the recent book Sex and the Citizen, How the Assault on Marriage is Destroying Democracy. Con, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Why should we care about marriage? What do we know about its benefits for those who are involved, perhaps children involved? Why is marriage so important?
Yeah, well, I think if you look at pretty much any issue today, marriage has a huge impact on it. When you look at income inequality, the widening income inequality gap in this country is largely driven by the decline of marriage. Same with wealth inequality. Same with decreasing mobility. I mean, you know, we used to grow in a country where not only did Americans live to out-earn and out-succeed their parents, but people believed it was possible. And neither of those are true today. The younger generations today don't believe the American dream exists, and it actually does not. And this is largely driven by the decline of marriage. Crime, also driven by marriage. Loneliness, isolation, depression. Even polarization within our politics is also largely driven by the decline of marriage. And then, of course, there's the future of humanity. You're seeing this demographic decline, not just in this country, but across the world. And again, also being driven by the decline of marriage. So pick any issue you want out there. Marriage is a huge reason why the problem is growing.
And we'll come back to a couple of those issues later on in the conversation. Early in the introduction in Sex and the Citizen, you note that the acceptability of polygamy from 5% to, my recollection is correct, 25% or so in the span of 20 years, from 2004 through 2024, roughly. That's a huge jump. How do those numbers or the changing opinions of Americans on polygamy also factor into this discussion of marriage?
Yeah, well, even that number, the 5 to 25%, that doesn't show the concentration of that growth is all in the younger generation. So you have a younger generation coming up, which has largely abandoned the idea or the placement of monogamy as the foundation of civil society. And they're just much more accepting of pretty much all sexual behavior as liberated as they want it to be. And, you know, the whole point of the book is that this is a huge mistake for a number of reasons, mostly because we are actually hardwired to be monogamous, and that when we stray around that, and then that when we do not allow culture and the government to work together to help channel individual behavior into monogamous relationships, when we instead encourage the opposite, it's basically a denial of the soul. We are not allowing humans to reach their full potential.
You say we're hardwired to be monogamous. The polygamy supporters or other people who are on the assault against marriage would say that's not true at all. We never were supposed to be monogamous. We're always sort of sleeping around and doing what we want. Is that true? Where do we kind of start the idea of marriage?
Sure. Well, marriage actually is part of why we're human. You know, it's what separates us from our ape ancestors. So when you look at kind of the history of marriage, you have people like Karl Marx and Engels who believed that humanity actually first existed in a promiscuous horde before marriage was then imposed on them by capitalism, property, and the church. And that's actually just false. They actually got that idea from an American anthropologist back in the 1800s, but that guy ended up being wrong. long story short, there is no hunter-gatherer tribe that has ever been encountered that did not have monogamous marriage at the core of their society. And it is the core of foundation. It is through monogamy that humans bring three generations into what I call a long-term project of cooperative care to help mom get the calories and help she needs to raise a child. So when you look at chimpanzees, not only do chimpanzees not help each other raise children, but the females within a chimpanzee troop will actually actively thwart each other, and the alpha females will actually, unfortunately, kidnap and starve the young children of the other chimpanzees. It's not until you get into a monogamous setting where you have a monogamous male partner there to protect all females, where you then have the children of this monogamous offspring recognizing the father and working with him. And then because it is the females chimpanzees that move at sexual maturity, it's only with monogamy that you have a grandparent, dad's mom, there to identify and see who her grandchildren are and then help out. And that is how you get three generations helping mom provide for children. And that is how we got our big brains and ended up conquering all seven continents of the world.
Con Carroll with us. His recent book, Sex and the Citizen, How the Assault on Marriage is Destroying Democracy. We also hear that, marriage is it's a creation of man to control women. In practice, does it work the other way around?
Yeah. So monogamy itself, which, kind of separate from marriage, you can have polygamous marriages. But, to be clear, polygamy was not something, kind of weird that Mormons used to do and Muslims still do. It was actually, the standard across humanity for pretty much all of recorded history. So as soon as you start having sedentary societies, as soon as you start having agriculture and property, then you start having people that, kind of specialize in the use of force in war. And that's when you have kind of a stratified society where you have a few men that monopolize most of the women, which is not good for the men that are being oppressed, but it's not good for the women either. And so it's really not until you have Christianity come along that says, look, we have everyone has equal human dignity, and it is, just as the man has dominion over the woman's body, the woman also has equal dominion over the man's body. And that was what was truly revolutionary about Christianity and, ended up changing the entire world.
The most recent of the revolutions you outline is moral relativism, individualism when it comes to marriage, relationships, and this idea that perhaps we are providing economic incentives for broken families. How did this come about?
Unfortunately, you can see it right there in the data. So, for pretty much the entirety of the time that the United States Census existed, some pretty much the Civil War on, about 75% of all households in the United States were led by married couples. Okay. That started falling pretty much in the 1970s after a Supreme Court case called King v. Smith. Okay. And so what happened in this case is you had what it was originally was aid to dependent children, which was later changed to aid to families with dependent children. When this was administered, it was financed by the federal government, but administered by the states. So states would then go around and make sure that households that were receiving this aid were good households, were worthy of the benefit. And so one of the rules they had was so-called man of the house rules that checked to make sure that women were not sleeping with the man who should be providing for the mother in question. So in 1968, you had welfare advocates in Alabama challenge Alabama's man of the house rules, and Congress sided with the welfare advocates. Now, Alabama argued at the time, if you got rid of this man of the house rule, what that meant was women were now faced with a choice. If you wanted to live with a man, as most women do, you could either A, marry that man and lose your welfare benefits, or B, not marry that man, cohabitate with him, or, date. Or date him and still get the benefits. So you force that choice upon them. And then since then, in the immediate decade after that, the percentage of young black women who were married fell from like 60% all the way down to 20% and has never recovered.
Con Carroll is with us. We'll be back in a moment to talk more about his book, Sex and the Citizen, How the Assault on Marriage is Destroying Democracy. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Get ready to explore the expansive universe of aviation and cutting-edge space technology in Turtle Bay's newest exhibition, Mission Aerospace, presented by Dr. Eric and Tiffany Blassingame and produced by Minotaur Mazes, on display at Turtle Bay Museum January 18th through April 20th. This highly interactive maze puzzle is sure to inspire all generations. Mission Aerospace at Turtle Bay Museum is free for members and included with paid admission. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Hi, this is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
KCNR invites you to join us the second Friday of the month starting at 8 a.m. for the Gorman Law Hour featuring local attorney Patrick Gorman, a legal expert when it comes to injured workers, compensation claims, and employee claims. So, if you have a legal question or just wonder whether or not you have a legal issue or problem, talk to Patrick Gorman, attorney at law, during the Gorman Law Hour starting at 8 a.m. the second Friday of the month on KCNR.
Hi, it's Mark from Haven Humane Society. Are you looking to add to your family? We have puppies, kittens, small critters, and farm animals. Each year, we have thousands of amazing animals looking for homes come into our lives, and we hope to have them join yours. Follow us on social media and find our links on our website at havenhumane.org. Watch our weekly content on YouTube, like our Mark's Monday mashup, when we talk about what's going on and introduce you to our team and adoptable animals. Get involved. Volunteer. Thank you for all your continued support. Together, we are moving closer to our ultimate goal of a North State with no more homeless pets.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
This is Carl Bott. Join us on Thursday as we welcome Patrick Jones, former Shasta County Supervisor, and find out what his plans for the future are. Also, Kimberly Johnson, CEO of Arches, and the latest of what's happening with that organization. All of this Thursday, right here. Free Fire Radio, KCNR, 96.5 FM, 1460 AM, your talk radio. Miss a day, miss a lot.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, talking with Con Carroll. His book is Sex and the Citizen, How the Assault on Marriage is Destroying Democracy. A key question, as long as sex is consensual, are other people harmed when unmarried people choose to have sex? And we go back to the beginning of the conversation and the consequences, exacerbating wealth and income inequality, worsening political polarization, and then, of course, the population decline and the decline in the, you know, births in our country. What are these consequences that we should be concerned about as people are working on the assault on marriage?
Yeah, you know, I was surprised in researching this book, the, you know, a quote, not, I mean, I don't know if you read that quote from the book, but there's a very close quote to it from Jonathan Turley, who's come in, who has kind of become more of a conservative voice in the Biden era and in the Trump era, but he was actually more of a libertarian before. And he represented a number of polygamous families who wanted to have their marriages recognized, or at least not criminalized by the state. And so he makes the argument that, you know, what goes on behind closed doors sexually is only up to, only affects the people in that relationship in that time, and it doesn't affect anyone else. And as I point out in the chapter you just kind of outlined, that's just simply not true. And that once the state is not able to funnel sexual desire into monogamous unions, so many other things fall apart. You mentioned, you know, income inequality, because it's generational. Particularly young men do not grow up, do not attain the discipline, do not have, as I put it, the role models needed to transition from adolescence into being a successful adult. And so what that means is that when you look at the outcomes for unmarried families, when you look at the outcomes for boys, they are particularly bad, and that really starts then milling into a longer cycle of once one generation has more males that are not as economically successful, that just means fewer marriages in the next generation. Mm-hmm. And so you just get this poverty cycle that we unfortunately see in a lot of communities today.
So, Khan, why does marriage work? Why does it bring us all these benefits? Why is it better than, say, simple cohabitation when you want to live together but not get married?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like that adage that, you know, democracy is the worst form of government, but all the others, you know. So I do have a chapter in the book, Why Marriage Works. And the thesis of the chapter is basically that, look, as humans, we have these emotional and physical intimacy needs that have to be met. Okay, they're not as pressing as the need for water or the need for food, but they exist and they're strong and they need to be met. So how are you going to meet them? Is it going to be through cohabitation, which is a lot less structured and a lot more unstable? Is it through polyamory? Is it through polygamy? So there's actually a lot of research been done on all of these institutions of how humans live together and meet their emotional and physical and intimacy needs. And monogamous marriage comes out on top compared to all the others. You just have a lot more crime and abuse with polygamy. Polyamory, you just have a lot of divorce. Cohabitation, the relationships through cohabitation are a lot more unstable, don't last as long through monogamous marriage. So, you know, look, divorce happens. People are human. Marriage is not some silver bullet that if you walk down the aisle and say, I do, your life is suddenly going to be perfect. Mm-hmm. Marriage is work. But overall, it is the best institution to not just channel your individual needs, but society's overall, their needs for physical, emotional intimacy into this institution that has proven to be the best way to encourage human flourishing.
Con Carroll with us. His recent book, Sex and the Citizen, How the Assault on Marriage is Destroying Democracy. We have, over the past decade, more than that, this idea of perhaps American citizens being married to the state. People might remember the character Julia from, goodness gracious, more than a decade ago at this point, as the Obama administration was trying to describe how a single woman's interactions with the state, with the government, could perhaps replace all of these benefits of marriage. Why does being married to the state not give us the same sense of both satisfaction and the same sense of wholeness?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. I think the main one is that a lot for especially the children, especially the males there, you know, you don't have that male role model there. But, you know, kind of more important than that is, you know, you can't snuggle the state at night. You know, the state's not going to sit on the couch and listen to you. The state is just not another person who can sit down and really connect with you. But another person is. And so, you know, when you look at a lot of the feminist project and what they're trying to accomplish, it a lot is unfortunately specifically trying to undermine marriage in order to promote female success in the professional workplace. And so I had this quote from Hannah Rosen in the book, who says flat out that, you know, women's professional success is due to the decline of marriage. And I just think that's a mistake to encourage women to become married and depend on the state and not to meet those needs when in the form of a real person.
So what do we do about this assault on marriage, and how do we encourage marriage? You write a bit about lessons we can learn perhaps from some things the U.S. military have implemented.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I don't think I actually suggest that we adopt the military's promotion of marriage. But what they did decide when they went away from the draft was that they needed to find a way to keep a more stable amount of people in the force. And what they did is they encouraged marriage. So if you get married, you flat out get a bonus, which would be great, but I don't even think we need to go that far. And then if you get married, you also get better housing benefits than if you were not married. So there are some ways in which the armed forces encourage marriage. And if you look at the numbers, the armed forces, even without the, you know, higher educations of certain other demographics, is, you know, they're getting married like was the 1950s. So these incentives, these bonuses are shown to work. But I think most importantly, we have to start with is we have to stop that $1 trillion that's being spent every year punishing marriage. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean we have to get rid of the entire social welfare state. It doesn't mean we have to get rid of Medicaid and Section 8 housing and food stamps and everything else. But we do need to get rid of the marriage penalties within those programs. And then another area I really look at is making young men more marriageable. When you look at wage growth over the past 50 years, since 1970, wage growth for college-educated men has gone through the roof. Wage growth for women of all education levels has risen. But when you look at low-skill male wages, those have actually fallen since 1970. And that's just one way that makes them less marriageable. There's some ways we can address that. We can limit low-skill immigration so that the jobs available for those men are paid more. We can limit trade to China, which has just destroyed manufacturing. But there's some other things we could do that, you know, are kind of new on the radar, that maybe not fit into a left-right mold that we should look into.
Con Carroll, we just went through an election cycle where seemingly everything in some way was a threat to democracy. So your book says the assault on marriage also is destroying democracy. How so?
Well, a number of ways. I mean, you know, as I detail in the chapter of the destruction of democracy, you know, income inequality undermines democracy. There's studies on that. So does wealth inequality. When people don't believe that by playing by the rules and working hard, they can get ahead, that undermines democracy. So if you have a decreasing social mobility because of marriage, that's also going to decrease belief in democracy. Same with crime. You can't have high crime in democratic institutions. But one really that I zero in on is polarization, which, you know, since the Democratic Party within the past 20 years or so has really become the party of the single woke female.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much if you look at the Kamala Harris, right, and all of those issues that she realized were so far left when she got the nomination that she had to walk all of them back, you know, talk about the trans stuff, talk about decriminalizing the border. Those are all issues that were pushed that have their highest support among the single woke female demographic. It is single woke females that have driven the Democratic Party so far to the left that everyone on that stage in 2020, when asked, you know, do you believe that the border should be decriminalized? You know, Joe Biden was the only one that didn't raise his hand. Everyone else did. And that is a position that was driven by the decline of marriage because of the polarization of single woke females.
Con Carroll is commentary editor at the Washington Examiner, WashingtonExaminer.com. Find him on X at Con Carroll. And his latest book is Sex and the Citizen, How the Assault on Marriage is Destroying Democracy. Con, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Up next, Brent Klein joins us. He's from Hillsdale's English Department. We'll begin a discussion on the Harlem Renaissance Movement. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Ready to turn your dreams into reality? At Simpson University, we offer a private Christian education that enriches your academic journey with faith and purpose. Whether you're pursuing your undergraduate degree, completing your degree, or advancing through graduate studies, our dynamic programs, personalized mentorship, and vibrant community are here to support you. Discover how Simpson University can help you achieve your goals and grow spiritually. Visit simpsonu.edu today to learn more. Simpson University, where your potential is limitless.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Auto Body. You've been in an accident with your vehicle. You call your insurance. The first thing they do is tell you where to go to get an estimate and repairs. Well, tell them where to go and come see us at Coachmaster. They're sending you to their discount repair shop to get the cheapest repair possible. This is not in your best interest. You have the right to choose Coachmaster to do your repairs. All we need is your claim number and we can handle the entire process. At Coachmaster, we don't repair your vehicle for the insurance company. We repair it for you. We use quality parts and products to ensure the highest quality repairs. Your vehicle will be returned to a pre-loss condition. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Coachmaster Collision Repair continues to be the leader in the North State for advanced technology in the collision repair industry. Remember Coachmaster on East Side Road. Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
Join Aaron Ryan and Bill Cundiff for We the People Radio every Sunday from noon until 2. Our expert guests will give you the whole story rather than a bunch of sound bites. Our commercial-free archives are always available at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sponsored in part by Pape Machinery, located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, for all your local John Deere ag and turf products. Join us every Sunday from noon until 2, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them?
Good morning, Reading. This is Rick Hughes, host of The Flatline. Heard every Sunday morning on KCNR 96.5 FM at 7 a.m. in the morning. Just want you to know that God has given us two ends, one to think with and one to sit on. And success in life depends on which one you use. It's heads you win and tails you lose. Come join me on The Flatline and learn about God's tremendous problem-solving device. 7 a.m. every Sunday morning, 96.5 FM, KCNR.
Join Tokens Radio Show every Sunday at 2 p.m. on 96.5 FM and AM 1460 as host Christy Matthews and Linda Kent explore the exciting world of cryptocurrency and blockchain technology. Learn how Bitcoin is revolutionizing finance and grasp sound money principles. Hear new perspectives on achieving financial freedom beyond broken institutions. The future of money is here. Empower yourself with knowledge. Listen to Tokens Radio Show with Linda and Christy this Sunday at 2 p.m. on KCNR. Big and exciting changes are underway.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to follow us on X for updated show and guest information. We're at Hillsdale Radio. We're joined by Dr. Brent Klein. He is Associate Professor of English here at Hillsdale College. Dr. Klein, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Beginning today, a series of interviews on the Harlem Renaissance. And this first conversation will give us a good overview background on this movement. Tell us, as we begin, the era we're talking about, some of the social, cultural, economic factors that contributed to what we now call the Harlem Renaissance.
Like any era or movement that you might consider, the idea of a beginning and the idea of an ending is going to be somewhat fuzzy, but you can roughly put it at World War One, the end of World War One, to some people put it around the Great Depression, 1929, but I think more fairly, you can think start of World War II, that's about when it's over.
How did the Great Migration influence the Harlem Renaissance, both in terms of the themes explored in this literature and the influx of talent to Harlem?
Yeah, because it's not as though Harlem is the only place this Renaissance is happening. It's happening in Chicago. It's happening in St. Louis. But the Great Migration is incredibly important, but it's as chaotic as it is unifying, because when you mention the Great Migration, so just for your listeners, the Great Migration is this decades-long process of African Americans moving from the South to the North, and it's almost always moving from rural South to urban North. And, you know, when the very contours of what you think of with an American city is forming with the Great Migration. When I teach the Harlem Renaissance, I ask students where they're from, and if they're from rural Michigan, rural Indiana, I ask them, okay, what's the racial demographics? And of course, it's almost always white and now perhaps Hispanic as well. Mm-hmm. And then I ask them, why is that? Like, why is that the case? Because if you go down to low country South Carolina, that's certainly not the case.
Right.
And it's because when you're migrating to the cities almost always. And so the Great Migration is happening because of Jim Crow. It's happening because of increased industry in the North. So there's a push-pull going on, being pushed away from the south, excuse me, being pulled toward the North. And when you come to Harlem, it's not as though Harlem is empty.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Northern African Americans who are urbanites taking in these large numbers of rural Southerners, and they don't get along. And this is actually represented in a lot of the literature. In fact, one of the great conflicts of the Harlem Renaissance, because I think you can think about that era as much as an era of rival factions as much as a unified idea,
mm-hmm.
is what are we as a race in this country? What are we as a people? And is that to include these Southern rural folk who are coming that we think perhaps we're a little bit better than? And yet at the same time, these Southern rural folk represent a heritage that in the 20th century is really just beginning to be wrestled with. You know, I mentioned in terms of beginnings, you know, around World War One, but one of the reasons World War One is a beginning for the Harlem Renaissance is because in the late 19th century, you have this growth of a, for lack of a better term, a black bourgeoisie. You're having more and more black professionals, and their relationship with their heritage, their relationship with slavery and the South in general is extremely fraught with problems. And one of the more important figures of the Harlem Renaissance is James Weldon Johnson. And one of the important things he does is he creates an anthology of spirituals, which for us in the 21st century, we just think of spirituals like, oh, of course, we all know what spirituals are. And they are performed by both black, white, all kinds of racial choirs. But at the beginning of the 20th century, it's much more of a, how are we supposed to feel? Are we ashamed of this?
Mm-hmm.
Or is this something we're going to embrace?
Talking with Dr. Brent Klein about the Harlem Renaissance, what were some of the key themes, some of the key motifs presented in Harlem Renaissance literature? And how do they reflect the experiences that you just talked about and perhaps the aspirations of African-Americans during this time?
Yeah, I mean, there are literal books written on subsections of this very question, but I think very broadly you can think of the Harlem Renaissance as an artistic coming of age whose most important questions are, who were we, looking backwards towards not only slavery but then post-emancipation, because the Harlem Renaissance is roughly 50 years of post-emancipation. Who were we? Who are we right now? And then what is it that we want to become?
Mm-hmm.
And those questions are contradictory. Different writers take completely different tacks. I'm going to embrace this. I'm going to reject this. This is my heritage. No, this is not my heritage. So, I think all things considered, that's the most umbrella way of understanding it. But then you can think about that economically. You can think about that politically. So, for instance, W.E.B. Du Bois is a Harlem Renaissance kingmaker. He is arguably the godfather of the Harlem Renaissance. And he's interested in not only the cultural aspirations of black Americans, but also the political aspirations.
Mm-hmm.
But then he's responding to a generation before him with Booker T. Washington, so the 19th century, who says, don't get involved in politics, black Americans, let's just deal with economics. The benevolent whites will let us have our economics and we won't ask for anything more. So that idea of Booker T. Washington is still in the water during the Harlem Renaissance. And so how much this plays out in politics, how much this plays out in economics, how much this plays out in art is individualized in different groups and different authors.
You mentioned Du Bois. Who are some of the other notable writers, poets, intellectuals that we associate with the Harlem Renaissance movement?
It's fair to think about it as a couple generations, those who created it, and then those who sustained it. And the creators would be people like Du Bois. It would be someone like James Weldon Johnson, who I mentioned. Jesse Redmond Fawcett, who really help shepherd young writers. I mean, James Weldon Johnson and Fawcett really are more important as shepherds than they are individual writers. Claude McKay would be one of those first generations who is a Jamaican poet and novelist. And then you move into the second generation. When you get to the second generation, that might be some of the authors that your audience is more familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
Now you've got Langston Hughes. You've got Zora Neale Hurston. You have Nella Larsen, Jean Toomer. Where that first generation says, hey, we're establishing this, and the second generation says, here's the flourishing of it, and then by that third generation, things are starting to crumble. And maybe there's something metaphorical in that. You can sort of see an arc that's constant in American history, if not all history, where you have the first generation that founds something, the second generation reaps the harvest of that, and then the third generation, for circumstances inside or outside their control,
mm-hmm.
things just start slipping away.
Do we see its influence remain today in some works of American literature?
Yes. Sure. The short answer, yes. So, it's this crucible of incredibly chaotic and beautiful activity, and then generations from then on start responding to it. So you can certainly look at, Lorraine Hansberry is going to be responding to it in the 1950s. Then you're going to get to the Black Power movement and the Black Pride movement in the 60s and 70s. And you'll see it there. And then you'll see Toni Morrison, 1970s, as a continuation of that Black Pride movement. And then moving in, you know, borrowing some from Faulkner and borrowing some from the Harlem Renaissance. I think you can see it in Jesmyn Ward. I think you can see it in Colson Whitehead. Mm-hmm. Sort of wrestling with those, wrestling with not only the ideas of the Harlem Renaissance, of who were we, who are we, what do we want to be, but also how do we best then represent that? And do we represent that by being a part of an American canon? Or are we a separate canon unto itself? And that's one of the important issues of the Harlem Renaissance, is that idea of separatism versus integration. Are we trying to be a part of something, or do we realize that we can't ever be, and so we're doing our own thing? And Du Bois would represent, no, we are going to integrate. We are going to be a part of this larger idea of what is American. And then you have someone like, I can't say philosopher, but, a separatist like Marcus Garvey, who is going to help usher in this century-long idea of separatism, both politically but culturally and artistically as well.
Dr. Brent Klein, he is Associate Professor of English at Hillsdale College. As we begin our introduction into the Harlem Renaissance, we'll talk next time about some specific writers from this period. Dr. Klein, thanks so much for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Scott.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Larry Arn, president of Hillsdale College, Con Carroll, author of the new book, Sex and the Citizen, and Brent Klein from Hillsdale's English Department. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram. And this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Owners, landlords, and tenants trust Authority Property Management at 2663 Victor Avenue. They manage a variety of properties, including single-family homes, apartments, condos, townhouses, multifamily properties, and commercial properties. Authority Property Management offers full-time management, including finding and screening tenants, rent collection, financial reporting, and final walkthrough home inspections when they move out. Contact Authority Property Management today at 530-410-6085 and check out their website at authoritypm.com.
This is Carl Bott and Ted Leidy. We want to invite you to our new show, Man Up, the fourth Thursday of each month, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM.
Man Up, 6 to 7 p.m., where we explore the lost art of being a man.
Spirits, cigars, and hit the ground running when you get up in the morning. That's what Man Up's going to be about.
Oh, don't forget motorcycles, guns, and hard work every day.
And those things that men talk about when women aren't around.
That's right. Even cooking sometimes.
Even cooking sometimes. People, places, and things.
Serving your family, your community, and your country.
Man Up. Fourth Thursday of each month from 6 to 7 p.m. right here on Free Fire Radio.
Join me for the first Thursday of every month at 6 p.m. for my show, North State Now. In this one-hour show, we cover what's happening in the music scene, theater, food, and arts. We get in-depth interviews with local business owners, musicians, actors, and authors. Listen in, tune in, call in, participate. Win tickets to concerts and theater productions. It's a lot of fun, and believe me, it keeps us going. Join me, your host, Linda Bott, or North State Now, the first Thursday, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, also streaming at KCNR1460.com.
Hello there, this is Kevin Cry. Every other Sunday, I will be on KCNR, your talk radio, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. I will be discussing the issues that matter to you most. You'll be able to call in directly, ask questions, and have a dialogue open and free every other Sunday right here on KCNR, your talk radio.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.